What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
Hey everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of the Salad Box.
This is a good one, man.
This is a good one. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. Doesn't get any better than this. We got a great steakhouse, great song, Josh Mankiewicz. I mean, probably one of our best episodes here. Although all of them have been great, but this is kind of special for us.
Very special to have a guest of Josh's stature on here and to be eating at Smith and Walensky. It's a big deal for us.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Picked a good song to kind of with the Dateline theme today.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get any better. I mean, we did the St. Elmo's fire. That was a good connection with the steakhouse
at the
and the
St.
song.
Elmo's,
you know,
steakhouse. Yes.
But this one we thought about, and it's perfect. It's everybody out there knows what Dateline is all about. It's,
yeah, it's murder and mayhem.
Murder and mayhem. So we thought, What is Love by Hathaway would be a perfect song. You just heard a little bit of that. That was a huge song. You remember that song, Bob?
That? I do. I'm trying to erase it from my memory, but it's been around for a while. And the line that you know, that sort of connects it to our episode is "Baby, don't hurt me no more." I mean, everybody's hurting everybody.
Yeah,
we're not everybody.
What is love? What is love by Dateline NBC?
What's the name of the band? Hathaway.
Yeah.
They had a way with the lyric, apparently, because "Baby Don't Hurt Me," you know, that sold, was it 9 million copies, some crazy number like
released
that?
Released in May 8th of 1993, number one ever. Me and my buddies used to always, I mean, you've done that probably yourself, where you do parodies, you just kind of think of a song and you start singing it. So we used to literally, this is 1993, so 70s, I was like 26 years old, and me and my buddy would sit in the car, and we would just play this song and think of different things to say. So one of my good ones was, "What is love? Baby, don't hurt me, Hideo no more." He was a pitcher for the Dodgers back then, and we would just die laughing, just thinking of everything to rhyme for no more.
Stupid fun.
Just stupid fun for hours in a car.
Me of our Me and Mrs. Jones episode.
I love that one.
Shirley Jones.
Caldwell Jones. Barnaby Jones. I mean, just go on and on.
We're having
Catherine Zeta-Jones. Yeah. But this song was huge. Obviously, SNL kind of, I mean, it was already a good song in 93. Here, I'll give you some. I love doing the countries that it was number one in. I love just seeing the countries that didn't like it. You know what I mean? Like in, Belgium, it was number one. Canada was number 17 for some reason.
Canada.
Denmark won.
Holding
Europe
Canadians.
Won. France won. Germany, number two. These are, I mean, it was a huge hit all over
the
world.
How about the U.S.? It had to be number one here.
U.S., U.K. singles, number two. U.S. Billboard Hot 100, number 11.
11, okay. That's
U.S. Billboard Hot Dance Club Play, number nine. So it really wasn't a number one song, but they just played the living hell out of it for a long time. And then obviously, 2003 or whatever, SNL started using it for their clip with Jim Carrey and the guys dancing and stuff on the SNL clip.
When was Night at the Roxbury? That was the kind of the big one
The
movie that was, I mean, they made a SNL is famous for this, making movies out of skits, right?
Yeah.
That come from a lyric in a song. I mean, nobody milks something like Lorne Michaels, right?
No. I mean, heck yeah. Well, Tim Meadows did something like that, right? We were just talking about that off.
Yeah. What was his? The Ladies Man.
The Ladies Man.
Yeah. Night at the Roxbury, 1998. Good God. That's 21 years ago, Sal.
Wow. Holy cow. So it wasn't that long after
movie.
The song came out that the SNL started doing that skit. Stuff.
Right.
I just thought it was like years later for some reason.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, but that's that was the formula for SNL and people back then. It was just a funny skit, funny movie. Boom, everybody makes billions of dollars. And here we are producing what I think is one of the best podcasts. We can't say on air. On the net. And we're putting together money to eat at Smith and Walensky.
Sounds like a gun. I mean... It's a beautiful place, but
yeah. Did you bring your Smith and Walensky? You got that on your hip?
What do they give you when you? But this place is unbelievable. I mean, it's really nice. We're at the one in Columbus, Ohio, but they have them all over. I mean, they just opened one up in Taipei. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Taipei. I mean,
Taipei.
They got one in New York, London, Miami Beach, Las Vegas, Chicago. And then Columbus.
Isn't that funny?
We're at the one in Columbus.
Yeah.
And it's
Taipei,
beautiful.
I mean, Las Vegas. Columbus. I mean, don't our Ohio fans, and we have thousands of you, we're very glad that you listen to the show. And we don't get into that whole Wolverine Buckeye nonsense, whatever. We're all a family here. But it is kind of funny when you it's the only, say, I mean, it really sticks out. Las Vegas, Miami Beach, Chicago, Boston, Wellesley, Mass., and Columbus.
Well, let's say you're on a Wheel of Fortune and, you know, you're on Wheel of Fortune and they say, okay, you can win, you know, New York, L.A.,
yeah,
you know, Vegas, to maybe
Smith
Des Moines, Iowa.
Walensky.
Des Moines, Iowa's in there, too. You know, that's... But they got some really cool events here at Smith & Walensky. I mean, these guys...
Yeah, they do.
Are,
you were showing me those.
They got this thing coming up. They do it in November. They do it on November 14th. Listen to this. It's called The Whole Cow. Okay? That's what the event name is. And they invite guests to have the whole cow, literally, and eat it too, during the inaugural nose-to-tail dinner party on November 14th, taking place at each of its restaurants in Boston, Massachusetts, Chicago, Columbus, and Miami Beach. The one-night-only Epicurean experience is priced at $135 a person, excluding tax and gratuity, and will feature a 12-course tasting menu, drink pairings,
nice,
and an inside look at Smith & Walensky's sustainable sourcing process in their exclusive premium beef partner. I mean, what a night that
is.
12 course dinner.
Night.
I mean, that's just a little bit under my Sunday brunch with my parents. I mean, we do about 11 there, and this is 12. So
the whole cow. Can we get the hoof? I've never had hoof.
So if you're ever in Columbus, Ohio, or any of those other states, please come to this place. It's a great steakhouse, great menu. And we're going to be calling Josh Mankiewicz from here in just a couple minutes.
We are.
So that's kind of cool.
So glad to have him on the show. Josh Mankiewicz, our favorite reporter from our favorite show, Dateline.
I love Dateline.
NBC. And you know, and we're not making this up. Sal and I are completely fanboying here over the fact that Josh is on our show because we watch this show. We're either like on the rare night that we're home on a Friday, or now they're broadcasting on Saturday too.
Yeah.
We're watching that, or we're DVRing it to watch
Correct.
It on Sunday after we've done our gigs.
Correct.
Because we don't want to miss an episode.
No, I love it. It started in. When did Dateline?
1992.
Yeah. And did it start on Friday nights? Because it's a staple on Friday nights now, right?
It is. And I, you know what? I don't know what night it started on. It's a Friday night staple now. And now they're coming out like this is a Saturday that we're recording this, and there's going to be an episode tonight.
That's awesome.
And sometimes they have the 1 hour episodes, which are great, but the 2 hour episodes, man, I Sunday afternoons I just settle in. And I grab a glass of wine, or I'm eating popcorn and beer, and I watch.
Now, this is interesting. I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but can you imagine when we were younger, Friday nights was like the Love Boat and Fantasy Island.
Yeah.
So kids that are 20, 21, they get to watch Dateline. That's a hell of a lot better than Love Boat, right? Because that's their Friday night. My Friday night was Love Boat and Fantasy Island.
And
these guys
Donnie
get
and
Dateline
on too. Some other cheeseball,
not a murder mystery show.
No,
So man, I wish Dateline was on back then.
Captain Stubing or Gopher. We're definitely Dateline fans, and I want to talk just a moment here about obviously Josh is our favorite, but that there's a lot of correspondence on Dateline, and we love them all. Andrea Canning. Keith Morrison. Dennis Murphy. Yeah. Bill Hader does a wonderful Keith Morrison impression.
Yeah,
and does
he really
a great
does.
Josh
Mankiewicz.
Josh Mankiewicz, too,
great.
Recently, that he
Good
did on
stuff,
Kimmel.
Man.
So, Andrea Canning,
Keith
Morrison.
The leaves were chirping, and I just love when it just goes into it. It seems like it's going to be the nicest show.
Yeah.
You know, like
it's something awful. There
yeah,
was
then
a
it's
foot
just...
sticking out of the sewer.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of really good correspondence.
There are other correspondents. over the years, and of course Lester Holt is the host.
Brian Williams, yeah,
big names. But it's kind of the four of them now, the five of them, and Lester is hosting. And so let's talk a little bit about Josh. You did some research on him, which probably makes him very uncomfortable to hear that. But let's talk about his career, what he's done, and what you found out.
Well, he's born Joshua Paul Minkowitz on August 27th, 1955. He's been with Dateline since 1995.
Yeah, been there a while.
Been there a long time.
That's 24 years. Right?
Yeah, he's also a reporter for The Today Show and NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams and Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly. Before moving to NBC, Minkowitz worked as a producer and reporter for ABC News. His father, Frank Minkowitz, was Robert F. Kennedy's press secretary.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Fascinating.
Just a really, really big talent, and we're just so glad to have him here. And yeah. I'm excited about this.
Funny guy too.
Really funny guy.
And if you're on Twitter, you got to follow Josh Minkowitz, because Josh does a lot of different things that are not that he wouldn't necessarily do on the show, but really funny takes on Twitter. We correspond back and forth. And his Twitter handle is at Josh Minkowitz. Now, let me spell that for you. At Josh Minkowitz is spelled Mankiewicz. At Josh, Mankiewicz. Very funny guy. In fact, I'll read you one of his pinned tweet, which I always thought was hilarious. And we all know the pain in the ass people, vegans in our lives, right? I always want to tell you they're vegans.
Yeah.
Right. So he's got this. He says, give me a vegan, liberty, or give me still a vegan, death. Vegan Patrick Henry.
So anyway, without further ado, we've got him on the phone, and we're here and just about to enjoy a nice steak at Smith & Walensky. We just heard a great song, One Hit Wonder. But right now, here is our interview with Josh Minkowitz. Welcome to the show, Josh.
I'm delighted. Look, I do a lot of podcasts that are just about crime, you know, which is fine. I mean, that's my job and everything, and I have no problem with that. But it's great to do one that's also going to be about something else I love. So.
Well, there goes my 20 crime questions I was going to ask you, Josh.
Yeah.
kidding.
So did you do my favorite murder?
Yeah, that's known as the murder podcast.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I was on that. They have a giant audience.
Yes, they do.
They do live shows across the country. They sold out the Kodak Theater, which is in LA. It's like where the Emmys are. But I do a bunch of smaller ones, too, when people ask.
Well, that's really kind of you, because and I'll just say Sal and I are we're not bullshitting you when we tell you we are big fans of the show.
I love Josh. I've been watching it for years. I absolutely love it. I really do.
I had a night off, so I'm watching it last night, and I watch of course every episode you do. So it's just a real thing for us. So it's a pleasure to have you here. We really appreciate it.
I'm delighted to. I really am.
I wanted to just ask you the. Because one of your quotes here that Bob wrote in the email was that, and I think it's so true. It's probably my favorite question on here, but you said the show's more about the marriage than it is the murder. And I think that is so right, Josh. I think that's what resonated in this country was it wasn't just about the murder. It's about knowing who these people were before all this crazy stuff happens, you know?
The quote that we all come back to again and again is by Dennis Murphy, another Dateline correspondent, who says, notably, it's never the murder, it's always the marriage. I think he said that in a story, I think maybe about Dahlia Ippolito in Florida, who sort of famously found a hitman to kill her husband, who turned out to...
I remember that one.
So they staged the whole thing and made it look like the guy had died, and then he walked in while... And again, the marriage is the thing that connects the audience to Dateline and to true crime, because most people, I certainly hope, most people are never the victims of violent crime, and most people are not. But everybody has been in a relationship that didn't
Correct.
Work out the way they
yeah.
wanted it to.
Yep.
Right.
And that's the, or in some cases a marriage, a lot of which fail. you know, what's astonishing is the degree to which, you know, we find these guys, mostly guys, but not always, sometimes women, who think to themselves, the way out of this bad marriage or this bad relationship, I know, I'm going to kill them. And then I won't have to worry about having to tell people I'm divorced.
It's just a convenience thing at that point, apparently.
Yeah, it's astonishing how easily people go to that situation.
God, it's amazing.
Go to that solution instead of, you know, well, this isn't working out. We'll get divorced. It'll be sad. You know, we'll have to split up the house. Like, I don't quite understand how people get from there to murder, but they do.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There was one that the one that aired last night was Dennis Murphy, and it was a story about a guy who a former Marine, two service members who got together and immediately had a couple of kids, and he was charged with his wife's murder. And there was never anybody else that was a suspect. There was just nothing else plausible presented. And the guy wound up getting off. And I thought, okay, well, I personally thought the guy did it. There just wasn't anything right. else that pointed to anyone else. So I don't know if I'm obviously you know the episode I'm talking about, but... Yeah, it was exactly as you said. It was the marriage. Why did this come to this? How did this guy just do this and allow...
I mean, it was not too long ago. I was in San Diego interviewing a guy through a thick pane of glass in a lockup. And we're talking about how he came to try to kill his wife with a pipe bomb under her car.
And Jesus.
He got caught because one of his coworkers checked his browsing history at work, and he was like on a website called How to Kill Your Wife with a Pipe Bomb.
Oh, jeez.
And then he was ended up being arrested for this. And he, of course, it's always the guy who's the sort of know-it-all dad who's also a church deacon, you know?
Oh,
and
yes.
That's who he was. And he had begun a relationship with the woman that had been his girlfriend back in high school. And I think he wanted to run away with her. All of which is unfortunate if you're the wife, and you know, and crushing if you're her kids. But not a crime until you try to kill your way out of that situation.
Yeah, unreal.
Kill your way out of the situation.
Jeez.
Yeah, and I said to him, look, you know, did you ever think about getting a divorce? You know, but just getting a divorce, he goes, well, you know, in hindsight, Mr. Mankiewicz, that's probably something I should have thought about.
Oh, my God.
You know,
oh,
I mean, because if you had, you're because you know, his wife, by the way, survived. She's fine.
Oh, good. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, I mean, she had some injuries to her foot, but I think she's healed. If you had, your wife would hate you, kind of like she does now. Your kids would hate you, kind of like they do now. You wouldn't have any money, kind of like now. But you wouldn't be in here, you know?
Yeah, you'd be able to go to a bar and find another girl that hates you.
Yeah, yeah. You'd be with your girlfriend in Pennsylvania who'd be stuck with you. Yeah, so it is astonishing how people get to that point. And talking about how, you know, you thought it was a slam dunk case, but the jury didn't agree.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole separate thing that we run into all the time. There's I don't remember the specifics of the prosecution's case on that story, but there's a phenomenon that prosecutors talk about all the time now called the CSI effect, which is jurors have seen so many of these TV shows,
yeah,
like CSI and NCIS and things like that, where if there is not DNA... that proves that the accused committed the crime, and if there is not a piece of enhanced videotape that shows the person, you know, pulling the trigger or their license plate at the scene, all kinds of things that are shown on TV but aren't actually possible in real life, juries don't want to convict.
Wow.
That all those shows have made the bar go up, and things that used to work, like I saw the guy... you know, put bullets in his gun, and then I saw him walk over to the person who got killed. I saw him shoot some some bullets out of that person. That eyewitness testimony is not as good as it used to be.
Wow.
In part because we now know that eyewitness testimony isn't as reliable as we once thought it was.
Sure.
And also because these forensic advances have made juries expect them, particularly when their usefulness has been sort of completely blown out of proportion by dramatic television.
Right. That's that's really fascinating.
Wow, it is.
I hadn't known that until you brought that up. And
the flip side of that is that OJ today, in my opinion, would be convicted almost immediately.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah. Josh, that's so funny you just brought that up. I'm like, I guess that whole ordeal would be so different today, is what you're saying.
Completely, because the audience, which is then becomes part of the jury, jurors understand now about DNA. Part of that trial was, and part of one of the 35 things that went wrong to the prosecution in that trial,
sure,
was that they had to explain DNA to people. It's really complicated and long and slow and dull.
Yeah,
yeah.
And made jurors kind of glaze over.
Sure.
Today, jurors take it on faith that DNA is better than fingerprints and that it's incredibly reliable and you can't question it. And DNA cases almost always go the way of the prosecution.
Right.
I mean, look, prosecutors almost always win. There are no prosecutors with losing records because they all go into court knowing that they have an overwhelming case, and they usually don't go into court unless they have a really good case. It's hard to find prosecutors who will go into court on any, certainly on any like murder case or anything like that, thinking, well, maybe we'll get him, maybe we won't.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They're going to prosecute unless they have a pretty good feeling that they're going to win the thing. I mean,
that's right. And that, and in some states, maybe all of them, but certainly in some states, there are canons of ethics that require them to not prosecute unless there is a reasonable belief that there's going to be a conviction.
Sure.
You can't just, oh, I don't like this guy, I'm going to let the jury decide.
It's got really interesting stuff, John. And like the flip side of what we're talking about, how jurors are more intelligent now with DNA and all that, it's almost like the criminals getting stupider or dumber in the years. Because like you just mentioned, the guy that Google searched to how to make a pipe bomb to kill your wife, doesn't he think, wait a minute, should I be searching this on my work computer, on any computer for that matter? Do these guys think?
I think that he thought that by searching at work, which was a, you know, shared computer network with some other people, that it would be better than doing it at home.
Okay. He did it on a shared network.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll fix it.
That was kind of a fun story, because his alibi about that, about those searches, was that some other people, he had allowed some other people, there were some people down there who were nomads. They lived in RVs and they drove around towns in California in the Southwest. And they would park next to his building. He would let them park next to his building so they could use his Wi-Fi.
Oh,
and,
right.
And that was his claim, was that one of them had conducted these searches.
This was probably the same.
Then he should have went to Applebee's and done it then.
This was the same satanic cult that was roaming Brentwood when OJ's wife got killed.
To some internet cafe.
Yeah.
The internet cafes are harder to find now because everybody's got a phone. But you could certainly, I mean, the way to have done that would have been to get a burner phone and go to a Starbucks.
Yeah, well, you know this because you're steeped in how to not get caught now because of all these idiots that have been profiled on Dateline.
Look, I mean, cops say all the time, you know, the dumb ones are easy to catch. People who think about it a lot, I mean, sometimes they get caught too, but they're, I mean, you know, the joke is, you know, well, we don't catch the smart ones. Well, they do catch the smart ones sometimes. But, yeah, in a lot of cases, first of all, you know, we're not covering the Ted Bundys, you know, on Dateline, you know?
Yeah, the criminal masterminds.
Yeah, we're not covering the people who've made killing their life's work. We're almost always covering people who, for reasons particular to them and their relationship, have never done it before.
Yeah,
and
that's a good point.
As a result, those people make a lot of mistakes.
Sure, which is beautiful for a two-hour episode of Dateline.
Oh, yeah, and I'm riveted every time.
Sometimes I won't even fast forward the commercials because I got to think about everything that just happened.
Well, let me just say, those of you who did not fast forward the commercials are the kind of people that we need more of in America.
Yeah,
well, you know,
Josh,
pays the bills. Yeah, we know all about that, sir. Well, I got a quick question for you that it's always, you know, I always thought when we talk, I wanted to pose this to you because it always rattles around in my noggin when I see the show, particularly on episodes that you're on. Has there ever, or is there a particular episode that gave you, Josh Mankiewicz, some personal satisfaction in its telling? Is like a, maybe there was more justice served, someone's innocence proven. Was there a particular story that you were involved in that you felt more deeply on a personal level and it worked out the way you thought and hoped it would?
Let's see. I did a story a couple of years ago about a guy in New York City, in the South Bronx, who was accused of a murder and convicted and sent away for, I guess, life. And he did 18 years before his attorney basically turned the tables and got his conviction expunged.
Okay.
And he was the result of just, I mean, that was the result of just somebody lying about him, which occasionally happens, and just horrific police work in which they did not even make any effort to check what witnesses were telling them. I did a stand up in that story in which I stood where the witness claimed she was standing and claimed to have seen this guy committing the crime and heard what he was saying, and then we put the camera back where we know the event actually happened, because there's crime scene photos of it, and from where the witness says she was standing, you couldn't even see that place, let alone possibly be able to hear what anybody was saying. And if police had done that 20 years earlier, that guy wouldn't have spent any time in prison.
Yeah, so you spend some personal time doing this and immediately see a flaw in the prosecution's case, didn't do.
Okay, I don't want to make it sound like, I got this guy out of jail. I did not. He was, the slightly longer story is that he was in prison and trying to get some lawyer to take his case, and a nun who did work in the prison hooked him up with some lawyer that she knew who wasn't even a criminal lawyer, and the guy sort of did it as a favor to the nun, and so he comes in and meets with Eric, that's the inmate, and says, well, all right, you know, I've never done this, but let me see your file. And so Eric gives him his, you know, the court file and the file about his conviction, all of which he's, you know, requested and which you're allowed to have if you've been convicted. And the lawyer says, where's the rest of it? And he says, no, this is it. He goes, well, it can't be. There's got to be more than this. You don't get put away for what's on here. Got to have more than this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He says, no, that's it. So he starts looking, the lawyer starts looking into it, and he actually undoes most of this. I mean, we were lucky enough to interview him while he was still locked up, and then after he got out, and then we spent a little time with him after he was a free man for the first time in all that time. And he's a very remarkable guy. But we did not, I mean, we're not responsible for getting him out. But we did, what we did do, I think, was, by dramatizing that, was we probably made it clear how preposterous the argument that he had actually committed the crime really was.
Okay.
Wow.
And so then when he sued the city and the state for all that wrongful prosecution and incarceration, he ended up getting a big settlement out of it.
Okay.
Wow.
So that
now, interestingly, which he set up a juice bar that he always wanted, and he wants to sort of start getting better food to people in prison.
Oh,
so that's,
okay.
With his money.
Great idea.
Well, so that's got to feel good on a personal level.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, you know, and that was a guy, I mean, you know, some of these people, like, as you say, some people believe they're absolutely 100% dead man guilty, and some people believe that they couldn't possibly have committed the crime. There wasn't any question in this case. He's not guilty. He didn't do it.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And I'm not going to go further, but I mean, we know who did do it, and they ended up confessing to it. So there really wasn't any question about that. But well,
has he invited you to his juice bar?
Oh yeah, I've been there. Yeah. He's,
oh, that's great.
He's, it's right back where he lived in the Bronx.
Ah, that's a great story.
You know, so that was like a sort of a feel-good story in the sense that, you know, you did see this guy triumph over the system. Again, I don't want to make it sound like we did it. We did.
Yeah.
But we did document it.
Yeah, you had a hand in it. You publicized it.
Wow.
You know, that's... and I mean, a lot of that wouldn't have happened without a bunch of sort of things serendipitously coming together, like the, you know, the nun and the lawyer, and somebody had, you know, he wrote a letter and it happened to get to exactly the guy who had taken the confession of the people who did
right.
do the crime.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I mean, it was like weird. So, but that was a good story. But, you know, a lot of stories that we do, either the person is clearly guilty, or, as has been the case probably a half dozen times, these are people who, you know, I think, like, well, you know, they're kind of a jerk. You know, they're a liar. You know, they've treated their family and others badly, but the case against them isn't so strong. And one of the problems is making the argument to a jury that, yeah, I'm an asshole, I'm a liar, I'm a cheater, you know, I cheated on my wife, I maybe stole from my company or something like that.
Sure.
But I'm not a murderer.
Yeah.
I draw the line there, right? That's a very difficult argument to make to a jury, and people frequently get convicted.
And I've seen a lot of those folks on Dateline over the years.
Right.
I remember I've got to piece this one together in my head. It was one about a guy who faked being his business partner for like a year and a half, and his family thought that this guy was, you know, globetrotting all over the world, when in fact he was already dead. And this guy was sending emails to the family saying, "No, I'm here, I'm doing this and that." And he was just the worst, the most despicable human being on the planet. And that was his defense in court. "Yeah, I know I'm a complete scumbag, but I didn't kill this guy." They're like, "No, you did."
"But I'm no killer."
Yeah.
We
actually have an easier time believing you're a killer.
That's a very tough argument to make. Yeah.
Well, I know Sal had a question for you.
Well, it's kind of along the lines of this, Josh. How do you find your stories? Do you stumble upon them? Are you guys searching newspapers and the internet? Are people calling in? Maybe somebody's sister's brother that was involved in some crazy murder or something.
Sal, you have just named all the ways we get the story. That is exactly it. Sometimes we hear from people who are personally involved. We read the papers all over the country every day. We're on their websites. A lot of prosecutors and cops and defense attorneys now that we've worked with over the years call us and say, "This is a story you should be doing."
Sure.
Local stations call and say, "You know, we've got a particularly weird story here that you might be interested in." So we start down the road on that. And sometimes I hear about stuff from people and think, "This could be a good story," and make a few calls. So, I mean, all of those ways. And, you know, and we have competition, and they're doing the same thing.
Right.
Know?
Yeah, there's definitely competition.
Yeah. You guys are number one at it, which is great.
Yeah, we are, but there are plenty of other, I mean, there's 20/20 and 48 hours on ABC and CBS, but there's also a lot of programs on cable.
Yes.
Do some things that we won't do, like pay people and hire actors to portray
scenes
in the narrative, which we can't do.
Sure.
And you know, one of the problems is that in a lot of cases, these families whose stories we're covering are people who really need money, because maybe the person who died was the breadwinner. You know.
Sure.
Oh, I never thought of that.
And so when we're talking to them, it's very hard to say, "Oh, you should not take money from this, you know,
right,
not terribly reputable cable show. You should do it for free with us."
Yes. Sure.
You know, so, I mean, I certainly understand why sometimes people want to get paid for this stuff, and that has resulted in occasionally us not doing some stories, because we're not going to pay people.
But I would imagine there's got to be a great sense of satisfaction with what you do sometimes when a family says to you, "Thank you for getting this story out and portraying it in a, you know, it's not sensationalistic, it's not disrespectful, it's interesting." I mean, you know, you're a reporter on a primetime television show. It has to be interesting, it has to be compelling, but it's always...
And it has to be truthful, that's
yes.
the thing.
Yeah. So people, yeah. I would imagine they probably thank you a lot for getting that story out and telling the story of their loved one, right?
They do, and sometimes that is absolutely the most gratifying part of it, is when you talk to these families afterwards and they say, thank you. You really got her. You really understand, you know, sort of what we wanted people to know. Because, you know, people, I mean, the local news is always available to people right after they lose somebody. But that story is going to be 1 minute long, and it's not going to have any context in it. So if you want the story of their life and what went wrong and who's responsible, or at least who they think's responsible, to be told, like, we are a good outlet for that, because we're going to spend an hour or 2 hours talking about that. And, you know, we try and talk to everyone. I mean, obviously, we try and talk to the defendant, even if they're locked up, even if the case against them is, you know, overwhelming. We still want to hear, you know, what's your defense? Well, my defense is, you know, it was these homeless people who surfed my internet. Okay, well, you're going to get some pushback on that.
But
at least you're
going
to get to make your argument.
Sure.
And also the family knows you're going to hear something about who they were, not just about the last seconds of their life.
That's interesting. Actually, I got two questions. The one kind of bases on this, Josh, is do you ever, when you guys are interviewing these people, do you ever, because you're so good at it, all you guys, everybody that's on that show, you guys are good interviewers. I mean, obviously, it's what you do for a living. Do they open up to...
That's the key. The interview is the key to making this work. But
correct.
Yeah, go on.
So do they spill more to you guys, almost as if you're an investigator or something? Like, do they tell you more than maybe what you guys thought you were going to get out of an interview sometimes?
Yes. Sometimes, if you do a good enough job. I mean, you're talking about families or the bad guy?
The bad guy. I'm sorry. I guess I should have.
Okay. Well, in the case of families, they're frequently very nervous before they do this, because they know that, like, this is maybe the only time that, you know, their brother, sister, son, daughter, wife, husband's story is going to get told in front of the country, and they're going to be doing the telling. So they want to, you know, they're like a little tense. What, you know, we spend a lot of time with those people trying to get them to relax, and sometimes the interview itself is sort of part of the therapy of getting them to talk about it, feel okay about it. And once, sometimes those interviews take several hours to do. That's not uncommon. I mean, I've done plenty of 3 and 4 hour interviews with people.
Wow. I would imagine, so, just getting them to overcome their nervousness and be able to speak about something that was tragic.
Right, and feel comfortable with you talking about not just what happened, but how they felt about what happened. And that's one of the tough things. Not just recounting what happened, but what I was thinking when I heard this or that, or, you know, how hard I tried to get them away from that boyfriend or something like that. Now, with the police, the challenge is getting them to be conversational and talk about it, because a lot of them are very worried about how they're going to be portrayed.
Yeah.
And they lapsed into that cop speak, which is not good.
They're not the most loquacious people to begin with.
And so sometimes part of that interview is getting them to feel comfortable also, and sort of talk about the crime and what it means or what it could mean. And then when you get to the people who are accused, or in some cases already convicted, I mean, a lot of people ask me, you know, are you scared to talk to murderers? I don't know how the other correspondents feel. I'm not. First of all, by the time they are talking to us, they're on their best behavior, whether they are locked up or not. They're definitely, their argument is almost always, this is a mistake, I didn't do it, it's a big conspiracy by, you know, the police or my wife's family, or these people are just dead wrong and I'm an innocent guy and everybody needs to understand that. So I never worry about that. And, you know, they get their say. They get to say, no, I was, you know, in Omaha at the time. And you know that of these emails that I sent saying, here I am in Omaha. So there's some pushback to that you can make based on things that the prosecution said. You know, in a lot of cases, these guys didn't testify. That's very common.
The
defense attorneys will tell their client, don't testify, make the state prove their case. Which, frankly, is sometimes results in a not guilty verdict, which is why defense attorneys do that. But so in some cases, when I'm talking to them, that's the only time that they're ever going to be cross-examined about their story.
Wow!
So that's kind of a big responsibility.
Yeah, right. It would be, and you're the only mouthpiece they have.
Right. I mean, they're not. They sat silently in court, and they all say, "I wanted to tell my story, but my attorney didn't want me to." That's very common.
Wow.
Now we usually understand why, because they're guilty of sin.
Yeah, and when they're talking to me, like in many cases, nobody has challenged them on their story since they were arrested because they invoked the right to counsel and stopped talking.
Wow. But that brings me to funny thing that I was laughing about last week. I was looking at and I'm obviously you had to have seen this several times. Bill Hader's impression of you.
That's good. That's really
Kimmel.
Good. So
that's
funny.
So funny about how.
So that's on another network, obviously.
Yeah, right.
And so we obviously, you know, NBC, we don't have anything to do with that. And so we heard about it about. Like late in the afternoon in New York, I got an email from somebody saying something is going on the Kimmel show, and we think that maybe you guys were mentioned. You should definitely tape it. If we hear about it, we will tell you more. So now I was like super interested, right? And we didn't know what it was. And then later in the day, I think the Kimmel show started putting bits of the interview up on their Twitter feed.
Okay.
And so then we did see it. So I remember before it aired, I knew what it was. I mean, I knew what was coming. And so I was able to tell, like, you know, pretty much everybody I knew you had to watch Jimmy Kimmel.
So funny. So great.
And Hader, who I don't know, I just thought, astonishing imitation. I mean, obviously,
it was pretty good.
Everybody had heard his imitation of Keith, which he did on Saturday Night Live, which is really good.
Yep.
Nobody had ever imitated me or Dennis before, and he was like right on the money. I thought he was great.
It was great.
Yeah, it was really great. And I don't know. I mean, I think I've heard this statement from you several times, so it might be, you know, it's everybody has some keystones in their act or their career, and I love how he brought out that. You know that is you sometimes say, you know, some people after seeing a foot sticking out of the leaves, they would have called 911, but you didn't.
You didn't do that, did you?
Yeah, you didn't do that.
You didn't do that, did you?
Last night I was at a restaurant here in Los Angeles, and the server came over, a woman, and said as we sat down, said to the two of us. Most people, when they find a dead body, they call 911. But you didn't do that.
So you're getting in a dinner now. That's hilarious.
And she said to me, "Now you probably have no idea what I'm talking about." I'm like, "Oh no, I know exactly what you're talking about."
So along the lines of, since we're in the comedy mode, and me and Bob are comedians, Josh, here's another question I have for you. I know you guys do a lot of production scenes. I know you guys do kind of just, you know. It was a Saturday morning, and the leaves were glistening and all that. But how do you get these criminals to drink a cup of coffee and look out the window for a couple of minutes for a shot? How do you do that?
The reflective, pensive shots.
We don't. Yeah. First of all, that's not in TV. That's known as B-roll. And, you know, generally people who are not in custody are happy to do anything that helps tell their
story.
You know, so I mean, if they are free pending trial or free because they were acquitted, they're usually happy to show that they're free.
Sure.
The thing that's hard for us is to tell a story of somebody who ends up getting locked up or ends up getting acquitted without giving that away.
Correct. And you guys have done that.
So,
you've done that
yes.
well.
Right. We obviously don't want to interview you the whole way through when you're wearing an orange jumpsuit. Because, you know, that's kind of a sign to the audience that things didn't go too well.
Giveaway.
So, you know, and we can't, I mean, there were times when we got away with it by framing people really tightly.
Yeah.
But if you do that, then you have to frame everybody really tightly.
Sure.
Or it becomes clear what you're doing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's happened is that some prisons will allow, if they're willing to permit interviews of inmates, which, for example, in California, here in California, they're not. You can't interview people after they've been convicted here.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, after they've been locked up. It was because Charles Manson was giving too many interviews.
All right.
Okay.
And so now people who are, like, not remotely famous can't be interviewed. But some prisons will allow us to dress the inmate in maybe the clothes that he keeps for when he's going to court or other clothing that he has that doesn't immediately say, you know, America's correctional experience. And that's great, because then we can, I mean, there was a guy we interviewed in the South, and they wouldn't let him take the coverall off, but they said, you know, he's wearing a T-shirt under it. They said, you can take the top part of the coverall off and just pull it down to his waist while he's sitting there. And then we went to Banana Republic that morning and bought a shirt. Right? Yeah. Before we went to the slammer, and then we put some candles.
As one does. I'm doing a Josh Mankiewicz right now.
And it looks like he's in his living room. And so we have him telling the story, and then all the way through, I'm on Twitter live when the broadcasts are on the air, and I see people saying, "Wow, I thought it was this guy, but he's not in custody, so it's obviously not that guy." And then we reveal at the end, of course, the thing is, like, you can only fool people for so long. Eventually, like, you're bound by the facts here, you know?
Right, yes. Yeah.
I mean, he got charged. We're going to say that, you know, he got charged, he got tried, he got convicted. But, you know, up to the point where he got charged, we didn't want to give away what had already happened. So,
right. And you guys do it beautifully, because you fool me.
Yeah, no, when that stuff works, it really works.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the idea is to, you know, tell a more interesting story. I mean, if you know in the first 5 seconds that, you know, so-and-so committed the crime, you're going to look at the whole hour completely differently.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why we do it. And it makes it more interesting.
And nobody's watching the commercials, which pays the bills for everybody.
That's right, which is, they're paying our mortgages.
Yes.
But the commercials, let me just say, America, they're fascinating, and those products, well, you'll be better off if you buy all of them.
Yes. Yes. And you should buy everything that's advertised on Dateline.
It's, absolutely.
Yes, we personally used all those products, and we vouched for them.
I've had Sal and I have had so much fun interviewing you, Josh, and we really appreciate you coming on. We literally could talk all day. I've got so many more questions, but we don't want to keep you too long. As we go around the country, Sal and I, we go to steakhouses, we crack wise, we act like idiots, and we have guests, and we're fortunate to have you today. And we do a lot of bits and stuff on the air. And we found out, you and I, when I was talking to you about being on the show, that you're a steakhouse aficionado as well.
Yeah, I definitely am.
And you go on the road a lot, obviously, for the show. And so, you know, there's a way to find a steakhouse, and there's a way to, you know, find a good steakhouse. And I remember you and I chatted just a couple weeks ago, and you were in Vegas, and I was telling you that we just did a show from the Golden Steer,
which is such a wonderful place.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about. What your experience at the Golden Steer? What do you love about it?
Well, first of all, I love that you think that, like, you know, Frank and Sammy and Dean might just walk out of the back room, you know, holding a martini.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that restaurant is like a time machine.
It is.
And plenty of places like that. Also, Michael's Gourmet Room, also in Vegas. Same kind of place. Although Michael's looks more like the kind of place where you want to keep your back to the wall because somebody might get whacked.
Yeah, right. Some kind of good fellas.
But, yeah, I mean, look, we travel around the country, and you guys know this because you're road warriors too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, if you want, just land in Indianapolis and, you know, take a cab to your hotel and eat in your room and do the interviews the next day and take a cab back to the airport and fly out, and you'll have had a perfectly nice experience. But your Indianapolis experience is going to be completely different if, instead of eating in your room, you go to St. Elmo.
Exactly. Yes.
And then you'll have one of the great steak dinners available in the United States.
Yep.
I always try, when I'm on the road, if I have any time at all, to find some local restaurant. And, you know, look, I'm perfectly happy at a Morton's or the Palm, which is wonderful. I go there in Los Angeles all the time, or, you know, any of the other big chains. But it's great when you can find a place that is specific to the city. I mean, when I'm in Seattle, I try and go to the Met. You know, when I'm in Indianapolis, I try and go to St. Elmo's.
Yeah.
You know, Manny's in Minneapolis.
Manny's, okay.
That's right.
Manny.
Yep, I have been there.
Yeah. Gene and Giorgetti in Chicago.
Yep.
A lot of places in
Chicago. Yeah, fantastic places.
So, you know, there's the, and then, you know, all those places in New York City. You know, Jake's in Portland, Oregon. I was just telling somebody yesterday in Portland to go to Jake's.
Yeah, we've been to Jake's.
I mean, you know, traveling all the time, as you know, can be irritating and disorienting, and waiting in line at airports isn't a lot of fun. And, you know, everything's slower than it should be and takes forever sometimes. But one of the pleasures of it is being able to go places that don't exist anywhere else, which is what I was trying to do.
Yeah,
that's exactly what we're trying to do, Josh. I think, you know, there's a lot of Food Network shows like, Drive-ins, and Dives or whatever that's
right.
called.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
But they go to those little eateries. Nobody's ever really kind of gone to steakhouses, so that's what we're doing.
Which is a great idea.
Yeah. Thanks, Josh. It's great.
I'm glad you like it.
Absolutely.
Well, we hope to have a steak with you in person one day. This has been...
I would really love that.
Yeah,
I would love that.
Thank you. I would, too. We would both. And you've been... Listen, you've been most gracious to come on and share as much time with us as you have. We're really grateful for that. It is true. We are unabashed fans of Dateline, and we encourage everybody to watch that show because it really is the most entertaining show on TV.
It really is.
And I want to tell you.
Thank you.
It really is, yeah. And I want to tell you, too, now, most of the time, Sal and I are working Fridays and Saturdays, sometimes Thursday through Saturday at the various clubs we play around the country. But I don't miss an episode. I DVR it. I'll watch it.
Wow.
It's funny about the DVR because I'll DVR Dateline, and I think it's MSNBC does the repeats episodes.
Oh, and Oxygen and OWN and yeah.
So this is when I was married. It was really this is kind of a funny story. This is when I was married. My ex-wife or wife at the time was going through our DVR, and she goes, "Why do you have so many Dateline episodes?" She goes, "It fills up everything." I couldn't record Housewives of New York the other night because it was full of Datelines.
Let me just say, she was clearly the wrong woman for you.
All right, she didn't get you, Sal.
You filled up my DVR. She couldn't record Housewives of New York. Thank God.
You know, there's one of the things that happens when I'm traveling around the country is that people come up to me at airports and they're like, "Look, sorry to bother you, but I fell asleep or I had to take a phone call. What happened?" And, you know, the mystery of such and such.
No!
And, you know, the titles of these things are the only part of it that we don't have any role in writing. Like, we write the episodes. Like, we're all involved in that.
Yeah.
But we don't write the title. So when you say, you know, what happened, in the mystery of Crystal Cove, I'm like, and I say to people, which one was that? And they're like, it was a guy who was accused of killing his wife.
Really? That narrows it down.
I'm gonna need a little more than that. And then they tell me, and then I usually can remember. But,
sure.
So you are a major network star personality, and people are coming up to you in the airport going, "Yeah, I had too much Haagen-Dazs on Friday. Can you fill me in?"
You're right. I dozed off on the couch. Was that guy guilty? I'm like, yeah, he did it.
It's like going up to Tony Romo and going, "I missed the end of the Super Bowl. Yeah. Who won that game, Tony?"
Did you throw a pick or was it a TD? Yeah, that's great. Well, Josh, thank you so much again. This has been this has really been a treat.
Really big treat. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you, guys. And I hope we're sitting across from each other at a steakhouse one of these days.
Absolutely. So Let's make that happen, buddy. You have a great rest of the weekend out there in Los Angeles.
Thanks very much.
All right. Well, that's it for another.
That was awesome.
Yeah, that was great, wasn't it?
That was really good. He's so good. Yeah. That was,
and what a great guy to be on here and give
absolutely.
Us so much of his time.
Big deal for us, man.
And that's it for this Sal and Bob episode. Sally, always nice working with you, pal. We're so social, by the way.
We're so social. Don't forget, we're on iTunes and Facebook and On Tour podcasts, and we are very social guys.
We're going to take you out with another clip from Hathaway's "What Is Love?" B.
Baby, Don't Hurt Me. And by the way, if we've learned anything from this episode with Josh, it's that don't hurt each other out there. You could wind up on NBC on a Friday night.
Yeah, don't wind up on that show. But thank you so much for listening to The Sal and Bob Show.
Good night.